It has become an almost unavoidable part of modern life, social media. For the majority of us, it is easily and readily available. Personal information is shared like never before online, and access to information is immediate. Who would have thought not even 20 years ago we lived without Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook and Instagram? Here to look at those two decades of social media and make some unpredictable predictions about what's next are Tanya Lawcott, Assistant Professor at the School of Communications in DCU, Sinead O'Carroll, Editor with the Journal.ie, and Orla Condon, Content Editor at Extra.ie. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. I suppose at the beginning of the millennium, you know, the emergence of social media and access to being online at home, it was through dial-up, but so much has changed over the past 20 years, Sinead.
I think so much has changed in how we do it. But if you think about it, MSN Messenger set up in 1999. So those of us who remember going home and dialing up, I think of it as like the evolution of how that teenage trope of how long teenagers used to love spending on the phone, on the landline to friends. And, you know, that thing of parents giving out to you for spending 2 or 3 hours when you should be doing your homework or whatever else. MSN Messenger kind of replaced that. People would go in. And if you think about it, that's almost weirder than what we do on social media now, that you went into chat forums and talked to people all around the world who you didn't know. Like, obviously you talk to your friends as well. And so it is kind of a natural revolution that companies honed in on that almost addictive need of human beings to talk to each other in every form possible at every second possible. So the predictability of it, I guess, if you look back at 1999, That was there for us to see. What we probably didn't know is how many dark routes it could take and how addicted we could get to it. And then also how much companies could learn about us and how they can use those learnings in nefarious ways.
I suppose, Orla, you know, it was a place, like Sinead said, to connect, but also to make new friends and find people that you had similar interests with.
Yeah, I mean, like Sinead just said there, the dial-up, I mean, I was living in very rural Ireland. Dial-up for us was quite slow. And I have memories of going to my best friend's house for sleepovers and they had Wi-Fi. And I remember we would all get a 30-minute slot on our MSN to kind of message people. And it was this, like, excitement that we'd be able to talk to whoever we wanted, even though we were surrounded by our best friends. And I think even though today we're still very aware of what we're posting and we're still not quite there in protecting ourselves on social media, we were reckless with what we posted on, especially in the early days of Bebo and the early days of Facebook. I mean, I still will go back through my wall on Facebook in paranoia of stuff that we could have posted and just publicly on our wall. And it was just, you were reckless with the content that you were putting out there because you just didn't know any better. You didn't know that there was people watching and people were using that information for marketing purposes and all that kind of stuff. Whereas now I do feel that conversation has moved on, but we're still very loose in how we're posting online as well.
And I think a lot of people who were maybe teenagers during the Bebo years are quite delighted that it doesn't exist anymore. Even though you always have an online footprint, it's not as easy to access information anymore from that.
I would love to see my Bebo page, to be honest. I just think that would be a comic.
I think you're
itself.
The only one.
Yeah. I think it's interesting though how Ireland embraced Bebo more than other countries. The UK and Ireland, I think at one point Bebo said that it had over 1 million users in Ireland, and the AOL like disaster buyout was based on some of the figures from the UK and Ireland. So something in our psyche makes like us more susceptible to some of these social media outlets.
I feel like MySpace kind of dominated everywhere else and we really embraced the Bebo thing. I don't know, was it the fact that you could post kind of videos and there was multimedia that you could use and widgets and all this kind of stuff? It was really interactive. And I remember moving to Facebook thinking Facebook was so boring. All you could do was type in this message box and that was all you could do. But yeah, Bebo was just like, I remember, dominated our evenings after school when we were younger.
Tanya, I think, you know, part of the appeal is that there was something for everyone. It was a chance to explore your interests, what you might like, what you might not like, and talk to other people with similar ideologies.
Interesting, because to me, and I come from a slightly different part of the world, so still Europe, but like Ukraine, Russia, and to us, Bebo and MySpace were things that were kind of there, but we never really used them that much. So for us, the early 2000s were messengers, ICQ, not MSN, but also LiveJournal, which was this weird space where you could actually find people quite easily who were interested in the same things that you were interested in. Most of us were entirely anonymous, like nobody really used their real names. So a lot of our profiles are actually still out there, but you know, nobody knows that they're ours. So that's a safer way, I guess, of looking at the kind of the past. But yeah, I mean, it was really interesting and quite liberating, I think, to have that freedom to really just pursue the things that you were interested in, whether they were hobbies, crafts, or poetry, or whatever else it was, and to actually find that, wow, there are actually other people out there, and it's really easy to find them, and really easy to have these conversations without worrying about, you know, what you look like or how old you are. And I think to some extent that freedom has kind of been lost because of this constant awareness that we are being watched and tracked and our data is being used by these companies, because I don't think that was quite heavily weighing on our minds before.
It seemed quite freer. You know, you didn't have the restrictions, but that's also dangerous as well, because people were putting a lot of their lives, a lot of information about them online without really understanding possible future consequences of that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the kind of that part of media literacy was quite low. For what it's worth, though, I think that the level of kind of capitalization or marketization of these technologies was also quite low. And now it grew much faster than our awareness of it. But I think at that point, it really was mostly a safer space, also because there were fewer people on the internet and on all these platforms. But then, of course, you know, any space that is not regulated in any way becomes susceptible to problematic kind of issues, and to individuals who seek to either gain in very straightforward ways or to somehow abuse this freedom. And that was definitely also happening in these spaces, despite how innocent I think they seemed at the time.
I think for personal use as well, and for people's personal lives, Bebo took a turn as well with the top friends. And I think that's where you kind of see the starting point for a lot of what we see as cyberbullying now. The idea of putting a list of who your top friends up are, like, that now is quite obviously dangerous.
That was
listening
vicious,
back.
Yeah.
And it did become vicious in schools. And as Orla was saying, like, you got home from school and you went straight onto Bebo. And that's where a lot of cyberbullying, before we had a term for it, took place.
Absolutely. And just to even go into some of the benefits, I suppose, of social media during that time, it offered an opportunity as well for people to find jobs, to see what they were interested in, you know, the hashtags on the likes of Twitter, of Job Fairy. But also, if you were an artist as well, a chance to put your material online and a platform to do so. We had MySpace, where artists like Calvin Harris started out because they started posting their own music up there and got noticed by record companies, something that wasn't thought of 10 years previously, Orla.
I think, yeah, it opened a door to people that they could just, like you said earlier, skip the middleman and get their stuff out there. I mean, it's still happening through YouTube and Instagram and SoundCloud and places like that. And you see it a lot now with podcasts. I mean, everyone's making podcasts now, and you no longer need to be attached to a big publisher or a big media company to get that stuff out there. You just have to be willing to make it and share it through your own channels, and then it'll grow and grow and grow. But yeah, like, a lot of the artists that we listen to today are people that came from, like you said, MySpace or YouTube channels and things like that. I mean, I would have been a big, I would have loved YouTube through my teenage years, and I would have found a lot of my friends didn't. They didn't subscribe to people on YouTube and follow these kind of artists. Whereas I was very, I loved YouTube as a platform. I really thought it was a place where you could kind of really explore. It seemed so vast. And like that, a lot of musicians that I now listen to were people who I started out watching do covers on YouTube and now have millions and millions of followers across all their platforms, have record labels with some of the biggest labels in the world. And like, that all came through just innocently uploading for free off their own personal accounts.
And if you look back at Twitter back in 2010, say at the start of this decade, there's something quite quaint about it. Like, people will probably remember, like, tweet ups, like, people meet, I think that's what they were called, tweet ups. You would meet people who you had met through Twitter. Imagine doing that now. Like, you'd need an armed guard with you or something. Like, so, but it was a place that people actually enjoyed talking to each other, and it wasn't probably quite the echo chamber. You would actually have interesting discussions and then want to actually meet these people in real life. So the evolution of Twitter, I think, in the 10 years is probably one of the most fascinating aspects of social media.
And I think as well, in the mid-noughties, you know, we had more access. It went from dial-up to broadband, constant internet on our phone, 3G, 4G. We became, and we probably are, addicted and reliant on online life. And of course, marketing professionals saw that and took note how fast word can travel through these sites and try and influence people through different brands. Nobody likes ads, but they did it in a very clever way, Tanya.
Yeah, and I think there's been a kind of a really interesting evolution of both sort of how the platforms themselves understand what they are and what they do. With Twitter, with Facebook, I think we've seen this kind of evolution from, you know, this is just a place to tell people what's happening in your life, to this is a place where you have political discussions, and this is a place where you go to find out news and participate in the public sphere. But also, you're right that, you know, like brands and companies have also figured out that there is this kind of mix of really weird mix of like the public, where everybody comes to look at news and to share opinions, and the private, where like we still think of social media to various degrees as kind of intimate places, you know, where we do connect with people in very intimate ways. And I think they've tried to kind of hijack that intimacy a little bit and to use it to kind of transform advertising and transform marketing messages and to, you know, to, I mean, that's why we have the phenomenon of influencers, you know, people whose opinions we somehow trust. We can't really explain why. We don't really know why we trust them, but they exist. And the brands have sort of caught on to this very, I think, individual kind of power of influencing people. So I think that there's been a lot of really interesting changes in all spheres, you know, not just in how we build relationships and how we treat strangers, but also how we get news and also how we decide what we're going to buy.
It was kind of like almost an equalizer that we could have these aspirations, but they were more realistic aspirations because these influencers were more like us than, say, the Taylor Swifts or the Katie Taylors or Katy Perrys of the world. So they were bringing aspiration to us in a way that we can say, oh, that we could get there. So yeah, like you say, it was hijacked by that marketing, and now all of those people are multimillionaires and completely aspirational and not realistic.
Instagram was the birthplace of SponCon, like sponsor content, and like Instagram has now embedded software that you can tag items in pictures and you can go directly and buy them. Like it is a shopping app essentially now, as well as being a social media app. It's still the one that I will never delete off my phone. I first thing in the morning I go straight to my news app and then I'm straight into Instagram, and I love it. But it's totally saturated with sponsor content and influencers who are selling you hair vitamins and the latest body con dress that you need to buy and all this kind of stuff. I do think people are wiser to it. I think especially like my generation, when we started signing up to Instagram, it was, I mean, you followed the big stars, like the biggest people in the world, with, you know, singers like Taylor Swift, who had millions of followers around the world. Now you're following a girl who lives 20 minutes over the road from you, who has 10,000 followers, who was in the pennies you were in yesterday, and I can go in and buy that. And like that, I know they're not as aspirational, but we've way more access to what people are posting and sharing, and marketing to us now is way more accessible. It's our local shop rather than these this worldwide brand that could be in the high street in town or whatever.
But it wasn't always like that though. No. And you know, these influencers and social media influencers, they've gotten several slaps on the wrist, including here in Ireland, for not being transparent about the stuff that they are advertising, that they are getting paid for, sponsored content. And it's probably still going on. And I know it's a battle that the Advertising Authority have on their hands every day, every week when they get complaints about this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it goes back to this question of like, once these platforms become so large and start to wield all this power to connect people, to persuade people to buy things or to vote for a particular person, that's when we start to ask questions about transparency and accountability and regulation. And I think that, again, has been, for me at least, as a person who studies social media, the most noticeable shift in the conversations around these platforms, right? As they gain more power, people start to ask questions about, well, who decides whether or not you get influencers to mark their stuff with sponsored content or ads? Who decides whether or not you get politicians to mark their ads as political advertising? You know, all of the really manipulative stuff.
And look at that. The politics evolution, like in 2008, Obama's campaign was absolutely lauded for being like strategy genius. And, you know, forward on to 2016, and we're looking at it saying, actually, this is really problematic. When Trump did it, and a lot of Trump's campaign, some of the stuff, he used Hillary Clinton's own words against her in ads targeting Black Americans to try and depress her Black vote. That was an amazing political strategy. We see it now as a much more nefarious thing than when Obama targeted people to try and get them out to vote. Super PACs in America were always doing things that we would frown upon on this side of the world. So it's the context of all of it that we need to see it through as well, because we have handed the power to companies who really don't care in the same way that watchdogs do, that we had set up to try and control some of this.
Well, of course, because I think the companies, they're companies, so no matter how much they talk about community and responsibility and bringing people together, I mean, ultimately they care about growth and profit, right? And so I think it is important to have these conversations about how do we design these regulatory mechanisms, who gets to sit on these social media councils or other bodies that decide how moderation happens, how regulation happens, how much information you need to disclose. But, you know, but I think it's ultimately also because what the platforms are profiting from is our data, right? And so that, to me, that means that, well, it's our data, so we must have a say in how that data is used by other people to sell us things or to bring ideas before our eyes.
And I think it's becoming more streetwise as well, and what we can do to become more streetwise. And we saw through the 2016 campaign, you know, Russian interference there on social media, hundreds of millions of interactions with potential voters who believed they were interacting with real people online and talking to real people online, where that wasn't really the case. How do we get more savvy with technology, become more streetwise and know who we're talking to and identify the trolls or the fake accounts that might just be there to influence us?
I think there's two problems now. I think one of the things that we probably can predict for the next decade, just to skip ahead to the predictions, is that there probably will be a lot more work, and probably companies, could probably people who think that they can profit from this, around media literacy and protecting yourself when you are online, because, you know, that horse is bolted. Like, we're not going to be able to take a lot of this stuff back. But I think the other problem is, if you look at what happened in the UK election, a lot of the information and the misinformation, the disinformation being put out was more organic than it was bots or kind of orchestrated by particular parties. It was people who had heard one thing. It might have been orchestrated by the parties, but it spread like wildfire by real people. I'm thinking about the nurse story, you know, the amount of tweets that said, oh, I have a sister who works as a pediatric nurse in the hospital, and actually that picture can't be true because the bag wouldn't have that much oxygen in it, etc., etc., kind of plausible sounding excuses. Most of the people who posted that were real people. They weren't Russian bots. So there's two problems at play at the same time now for our elections in the coming years.
Right. But I think also, if we do go back to Russian bots, it's also, I think, quite easy to take that sort of narrative up and to just blame them for everything, as you say. But, you know, but part of the problem is we know that there was interference, but we were still not entirely sure what effect it had, because it was such a varied kind of set of approaches, right? And I think a lot of it was, well, they certainly did their homework, and some of their messages were quite obvious, but other messages basically showed that they kind of looked at what was on the agenda in the US, you know, things like racial tensions and other
immigration,
and they just used those, right? They used those topics to kind of stir up discontent and to basically stage dissent and to pretend like they were real people in the US who were calling for organizing protests and things like that. So I think it's not so much that we're not only talking about the power of social media, but we're just talking about, well, are we paying attention to what the issues are, and are the political candidates also paying attention, and are the voters paying attention, or are they just, you know, basically voting for personality? So I think it's kind of, it's not just social media literacy, but it's kind of I don't know, political literacy. So it's more than just trying to deal with social media or trying to kind of place all of the blame on social media.
And I think the US context is interesting there, because if you watch US television during any political campaign, like the rules there are lower base than what we would be used to here. So the things that political candidates can say on more traditional forms of media is very different to what you would see on this side of the water.
And I think as well, just staying with the politics side of things for a while, you know, we saw around 2010, 2011, the likes of the Arab Spring, a lot of that movement funneled through social media, the organisation of protests. And moving that into kind of the latter half of the decade, we had Sudan this year, we've had protests in Iraq as well, with people trying to maximise social media to get attention of what is happening on the ground. But probably governments have become more intelligent, have become more understanding of social media. So when these protests happen, online is basically shut down to stop it from happening. And there is a bit of more control there by foreign governments in relation to this.
Yeah, I mean, I think governments caught on quite early on to the power of, I mean, you know, the Arab Spring was in 2011 or slightly before. And basically, I think as early as that, governments caught on that social media is actually quite a good tool for bringing people together very quickly. Maybe not necessarily a good tool for like sustainable political power or sustainable growth of the protest, but definitely a tool that will help maximize the kind of effervescence. And so, but then, right, it really depends on what the style of government or what the regime is, because, you know, in many democratic countries, it would just be impossible to shut down the internet because the internet isn't run by the government. But if you have a country where it is controlled by the state, it's very easy to just shut down the whole thing, which is why it's so worrying, because, right, to have that kind of differential ownership and to figure out how do we regulate internet governance and internet freedom as well.
And Orla, I just want to bring you in here, because it seems that, you know, new generations are being brought in to news stories that they might have never heard about before. We had those protests in Sudan against a leader who was in power for decades, and we saw icons of young teenagers, celebrities turning blue in solidarity with that movement. Can you see the younger generation and the new generation getting more engaged in politics and understanding those protest movements from what they hear on social media and see as well?
Yeah, I mean, like here in Ireland, the repeal and the Eighth Amendment, that was our social organisation where we were sharing our messages on there. I mean, that was a social movement, and you saw it through that whole, like all that year and leading up to the referendum in May. Like, you saw the momentum building, and for a lot of people down the country, I mean, myself at the time, I was at home in Cork for a lot of it. You're not in Dublin city centre where the protests are happening and there's marches and all this kind of stuff, but you're connected because you're at home, you're watching the live stream, you're tweeting in, you're a part of the live stream on Instagram, you're whatever, you're adding to this voice online. So definitely there's a feeling that, maybe it's naive, but you feel like you're contributing and you're being heard, even though there's so many of you screaming about the same thing. And often places like Twitter is who's shouting louder. And I mean, you saw that in 2016 election, it was who's shouting louder. And like you're saying about the bots, I think they magnified what a lot of people were saying online, and a lot of people were probably happy to have those extra voices to be pushing on their agenda, you know. But repeal was a big thing for a lot of my friends and people who I knew were passionate about the subject, and that was purely through social media where that just gained momentum and the conversation was just dominating Twitter.
I think in Western style democracies, one of the things that organisers of political campaigns or candidates have to be really careful that what they're doing online is moved into the real life sphere. Like, look at Labour in the UK election, their popularity seemed to be really growing in those last few days before the UK went to the polls, and it was a complete it was a complete figment of social media. Like, I was even tweeting about Little Mix, the girl band were trying to get people, their fans, out to vote Labour, and there was a real like kind of momentum behind some of the tweets, and I thought it was really interesting, young people saying I've looked it up and I've read the Labour manifesto and it's really interesting and I'm going to go vote. So when you're reading that, you are thinking that narrative of younger people are getting interest in politics, you know, there's a big vote out there. And, you know, there was a big Labour vote, but it didn't change the narrative of the election whatsoever. So there has to be a real consciousness among political organisers that what's happening on social media has to be taken and replicated in real life.
Right, but I also think that, I mean, realistically, right, if we look at the place of social media in our life, they're not somehow separate, right? They're just part of the overall fabric. And so I think that's exactly how those who organise protests or those who want to increase political engagement should be viewing social media. I mean, they're certainly more effective at certain things, such as, for instance, gathering transnational or transborder or diaspora support for certain issues. We've certainly seen this with the marriage referendum in Ireland and also with the repeal and in a lot of other protests where there are huge diasporas and people living in exile supporting their country back home. But you're right, right, that it's not somehow, you know, offline is separate and online is separate. There's kind of a hybrid politics and a hybrid model of engagement where you have to do things in both places and in both spaces simultaneously.
And there was definitely a percentage of that as well. And I was that day of the election in the UK, like my whole feed was just Labour, Labour, Labour. And people weren't even writing anything other than just Labour. That was all they were writing. And it did feel, I mean, I was living in the echo chamber of this kind of thing of, oh, maybe it'll happen. Like maybe this is the time, like it's actually going to happen. It feels like everyone is voting Labour. People like Gary Lineker and all these really like influential voices in all aspects of entertainment and all this kind of stuff seemed to be really rallying the troops. And then there was definitely a small percentage of people, I mean, there was bad weather in the UK that day, there was a lot of rain. There was definitely a percentage of people who thought, oh, I'll just post it on my Twitter page and I'll get to the polls later, and then later came and it's raining. And like, there's definitely a small percentage of people who jump on that bandwagon of feeling like they're kind of politically engaged by tweeting about these issues and retweeting kind of a popular thing that's online and things like that, videos that have gone viral. Yeah. But then actually, like you said, putting it into action and going to the polls. Or
remember a few years ago, keyboard activism, that was the word du jour.
Yes, activism. So many terms.
And like the thunderclap and things like that.
Yeah, I think you're on the money there, Orla, about an echo chamber, because we all know what happened in that election. It was one of the worst elections for Labour in decades. What happened, they lost so many seats and the Conservatives came with a massive majority. But Tanya, I'm interested in asking you, through your research in DCU in particular, we see all these movements happening, and more recently the Me Too movement, which was absolutely massive. But do we run the risk on social media of moving into an almost cancel culture as well, and the possibility of defaming people and that echo chamber carrying a little bit too much weight?
I mean, I think we should be kind of judicious in the sense that, you know, whose voices are speaking, right? And who gets to speak in those echo chambers and who doesn't? Because I think especially with the Me Too movement, you could certainly argue that, I mean, there was quite a lot of negative emotion and there was quite a lot of vitriol. But I think some of it was also due to the fact that, you know, women's voices in those industries where the Me Too movement came out of, they just never get a chance to speak. So for them, really, this was not only an echo chamber, because the Me Too movement at some point went from that echo chamber of just these women talking to each other, and it gained a much broader global audience. And we've seen it kind of gain momentum, not just in the US, but also across the world in different cultures. So I think there are certainly unhelpful echo chambers. You know, everybody's congratulating each other on how great they are and then they lose the election. But I think in other cases, you know, such as empowering the voices of minorities and the voices of people who are more vulnerable, I think social media can be a really great tool, because sometimes really all you need is to see that there are other people out there like you who have the same issues, and that there is a solidarity that can emerge from that.
I think this idea of cancel culture is not only overstated, but it's used as a powerful tool for people who want to keep the status quo. Like, it cannot be a stronger phrase. People who, to use the word cancelled, often it's because of reprehensible behaviours. And that is not something that we should look at and go, God, we really shouldn't cancel that person. Like, it's absolutely correct to call out absolutely terrible behaviour, whether it's sexual assault, whether it's racism, whether it's hate speech. So I think labelling everything just really easily as, oh, we shouldn't have a pile on Twitter. Sometimes it might be that we actually should have a pile on. And the fact is, most people don't get cancelled. Like, there's a few that come to mind. Louis C.K., I'm pretty sure he's touring to sold out venues. You know, there's probably people here that I can't mention because of legal reasons who have not been cancelled in any way. But people have said on social media, we do not like your behaviour. That is completely fair free speech.
Another thing I want to get to, because there's just so much to talk about in relation to social media, is how when it came along, the online world, people were worried that traditional media like television, radio, it's over, it's dying. But what we've actually seen is a reinvigoration of this traditional media, especially with television, the use of social media and television together and bringing new experiences, Orla.
Yeah, I mean, with the rise of Netflix and all that kind of stuff, we drifted away from kind of scheduled TV and things like that. And, oh, I'll watch it when I want to watch it. And I'll watch it on my phone, on the bus, and then I'll finish it in the home. And then I'll finish it up in my room as I'm getting ready for bed. I'll control totally how I watch it. And I mean, the perfect example of how that was kind of shaken back into reality was, I mean, Love Island. Like, if, like, 3-4 years ago, if you said to me, you're going to sit down however many nights a week for an hour and watch this show, whether you love it or hate it, and I'm aware that most people hate it, I know it's trash, hook it to my veins, judge me if you want it. But I, like, we found a way to schedule our lives again back around television. And it kind of reminded me when we were younger and you'd have the Friday night late and you'd have winning streak on a Sunday and you'd know after winning streak you'd be going to bed for school and all this kind of stuff. It gave this kind of weird structure to your life again around telly. But again, you were still on your phone double screening and like shows like that. And I mean, Room to Improve, when that started, would you have predicted that that would be the conversation topic that it is?
Because it's a saviour for TV makers for two reasons. One is you don't want spoilers, so you're not going to watch Game of Thrones after the scheduled TV time because, oh my god, you're going to know who died. And I never watch it, but just people die all the time.
That's very realistic.
Good summary. And then the second one, it's the fear of missing out. Like, why would you watch the Late Late Toy Show on a Sunday morning when all of the action is actually happening on a Friday night and you could be the person who sends the tweet?
So it's that level of approval, isn't it, to know, oh, I got 100 likes there. That must have been a good tweet. Yeah. And it can really snowball, you know, something popular.
And I think, and there's something with sporting events as well, it becomes that nice place where your opinion can matter a little bit. You know, you don't have to be a Jamie Heaslip sitting on the bench in RTE's studio saying, you know, I think Joey Carberry should have been playing over Johnny Sexton there. Don't come at me, Leinster fans. But, you know, that's, you can actually go on Twitter and say, well, actually, I think it's the other way around because of this, and people can have a, and that's kind of where the nice conversations, and I think that's what keeps bringing us back.
Yeah, and I think that it is definitely being a boon for TV and even film makers because, you know, social media allow you to create this kind of participatory watching and this experience of like, and experiencing an event together by watching it all at the same time, but also by tweeting about it and by kind of connecting to other people. So I think this again, right, has also meant that the producers of television content, radio content, film content are also now thinking about new ways, right, of engaging with their audience. So for them, again, like, it's not just about making trailers, but it's also thinking about, well, what are we going to tweet about? And also, where is the trailer going to be first? Is it going to be on Twitter or is it going to be in the movie theaters, right? So we're seeing this kind of disaggregation of how people experience things, but also, like, yes, we can actually experience things together despite some people claiming that social media are making us lonely.
Sinead, do you want to come in there?
Yeah, just one final thing. Just, I've noticed we're on a Morning Ireland slot and Orla has said hook it to my veins and I've said don't come at me, so like our language has changed so much, so I don't know if we should apologise to Morning Ireland producers.
I don't think you should, you're moving it on.
Yeah, but language changes and we shouldn't rail against that, but definitely social media has become part of that conversation.
But it's also an extension. I mean, like some of the biggest shows, like a show like The West Wing, for example, which I love and I go back and binge often, like Aaron Sorkin had a plan for that in the first series, and on certain relationships that were going to grow, and he changed that because of feedback from audiences. He got rid of characters because of feedback from audiences. Now we just have quicker access, and that's why reality shows really feed on that, because we can tweet right now that we didn't like the decision that you just made, and come the end of the show that decision could be changed or adapted. And Love Island is the one that feeds off of that. They changed the structure of vote-offs and eliminations and competitions and all this based on feedback, and it is a 10-minute thing that every 10 minutes as they're checking Twitter, if the view of the audience is going a certain way and they want to embrace that, they can change and adapt to fit that. So it's just an extension of what was always kind of happening.
And I'm sure we'll see that happening when a new series starts in January, Orla, which I'm sure you're so excited for. I chatted at the start about unpredictable predictions. I mean, 20 years ago, we couldn't have imagined having this conversation. We wouldn't have even understood it. Can I get some predictions from you guys on where you see this going as we go into a new decade, into the 20s? Where could social media go from here, Sinead?
Well, I knew you were going to ask this, and I was thinking, I was like, imagine a few years ago thinking of Twitch so that we would think that grown adults would watch other grown adults playing video games on a live stream for hours. Like, I think it's just such an unpredictable space. I think what you can predict is that Facebook, there's not going to be a demise of Facebook in the next 10 years, because it is so big that the actual Facebook platform itself might have less use, but they are just hoovering up everything else that looks like it's taking off, you know, Instagram, WhatsApp. So that's my one prediction.
Orla?
I thinking about this, it's hard to kind of know where it's going to go, because I mean, even Instagram stories, when that started, what, like 2 years ago, I remember being like, oh, I hate this function, I don't want to embrace it, like it'll
I don't
go.
Like change.
Yeah, I like my Instagram just being pictures on a feed, and now it's like the feed is irrelevant, it's just Instagram stories, and that's in the space of like a year and a half, 2 years. I do think the whole like augmented reality and all that kind of stuff is quite interesting, and like I know Black Mirror has kind of had a lot of episodes where it's referenced kind of how we'll use social media in the future, and
which it's a television series which kind of looks at the future of social media and the impact on our lives.
You could definitely see some of those scenarios kind of coming into real life, and I do think like definitely in like kind of Tinder and online dating, I mean, people are going lazier and lazier and lazier with that stuff. They don't want to meet people, they'll talk for 8 weeks on Tinder and they don't want to go out and meet them. You can definitely see augmented reality being brought in there and being like, well, I can just sit at home and talk to this person at home, and then I don't have to waste 2 hours going out to meet this stranger. And I think that is definitely a way that like you can see it being used already on live streams and things, but that's definitely going to, I feel, be implemented more in day-to-day. And in Instagram as well, you could see it being for like live concerts and stuff, that you could buy a ticket to go see something in the Three Arena, but it's actually through augmented reality. And like, look, I've said it now, so now make it happen.
I don't know whether that's a scary prediction or something that's
we're
welcome.
Just gonna live in like incubated little vessels and never leave the house anymore. Like, that's what's going to happen.
Tanya, what do you think? What's your predictions?
I think in terms of some of the more optimistic stuff, I think going back to the idea of language changing, I think language is going to keep changing because that's what it does. And I'm personally looking forward to in 10 to 15 years not being able to understand half of what people who are younger than I am are saying. I think in terms of structure, I think there's quite a lot of dissatisfaction with the big platforms that are hoovering up everything. So I'm personally really looking forward to seeing what happens with new, smaller platforms, more decentralized, disaggregated kind of social media flavors. Because, you know, technology-wise, it's much, much easier now to build these protocols for messaging and encrypted communication. So I think that we will have a lot more choices. Now, they will all come with their repercussions. Obviously, Facebook has a huge audience and they have a lot of different functionality. But, you know, so we might go back to slightly more austere options. But also, I think video is going to be huge. So that's definitely not going away.
Well, in 10 years, we should come back and see who's right and who's wrong. Listen, Tanya Lockhart, Assistant Professor at the School of Communications in DCU, Sinead O'Carroll, Editor with thejournal.ie, and Orla Condon, Content Editor at extra.ie. Thank you so much for joining us on Morning Ireland.